Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. Our engineer is Patricia Kohlberg. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolution of the working class, the force that works underground even long before it bursts forth. A lot of folks have some misconceptions about what this thing is that we call class, and you can find out more about that this Friday on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, when the Old Mole's Joe Clement will be joining Annie Haynes to talk about the meaning of class and answer your questions about it, this Friday morning from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm, listener-sponsored, community-powered radio for Cascadia and the world. Today's Old Mole focuses for the next hour on money and public spending for human needs instead of corporate greed. First, Dan Jaffe speaks with Alejandro Carral, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about the legacy of fiscal austerity in Oregon and the possibilities for raising substantial new corporate tax revenue in the 2019 state legislative session. Then, Bill Resnick talks with labor lawyer Jay Youngdahl about the loss of defined benefit pensions and the need to keep defending Social Security. Finally today, on The Left and the Law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss why we shouldn't be spending our money on weaponizing the border and should instead be calling for open borders. Old Mole Variety Hour episodes are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Those audio posts generally include links or more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and from our KBOO page, you can subscribe to the show to have episodes and segments delivered directly to your preferred pod listening service. You can email us through our page on the KBOO website or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Contact us if you're doing activism, planning events, engaging in movement that our other listeners will want to know about. We'd love to hear from you. Now, we'll hear from Dan Jaffe and Alejandro Carral about Oregon's budget.
The Oregon legislature began its 2019 session last week, and for the first time in many years, proposals to raise major new revenue in the form of corporate taxes and other sources are on the table and are being actively promoted by Governor Kate Brown and the Democratic legislators, who now have a 60% supermajority in both houses, allowing them to raise revenue without Republican votes, as well as a crop of more progressive legislators. However, a series of tax cuts and restrictions on raising new revenue promoted by corporate and right-wing interests since 1990, approved by voters and many enshrined in the state constitution, have gutted funding for everything from K-12 education and higher education to healthcare, mental health, and infrastructure over the past three decades. Combine this with new corporate tax breaks and increasing corporate tax avoidance, and you've got a major fiscal hole with very serious social consequences. So how are the governor and Democrats proposing to raise $2 to $3 billion per biennium for K-12 education, and what else is possible with a Democratic supermajority? And will that nearly be enough to meaningfully restore the harm caused by 28 years or 30 years of fiscal austerity? What do progressive and left groups, organized labor, organizations of communities of color and low-income communities want to see happen, and what's being left out of the discussion or ruled off the table entirely? To help us sort out these questions, my guest is Alejandro Carral, the executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. It's a nonprofit research and analysis organization that works on issues of tax and budget fairness for low and middle income Oregonians. Welcome, Alejandro.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
So let's begin with a quick overview of the situation we're in. Very briefly, how would you describe the social legacy of the last, say, three decades of structural underfunding of human needs in Oregon? How bad is the situation?
Yeah, the situation is, I think, has been, as you've said, accumulating over the last three or four decades. And it's resulted in a significant underinvestment on critical services for Oregonians, from K through 12 to education, through obviously higher education, as we've seen tuition levels continue to rise. There's housing shortages, a lack of investment in public infrastructure. So the need is broad and deep and has accumulated over these 30 or 40 years, resulting in what we now feel like it's a structural set of deficits that we seem to not be able to overcome. So there's a need for investing in this infrastructure and services in a way that it's actually distributing the burden, the tax burden, on those that can afford to pay more.
So very briefly, and we'll get into more details in a moment, what are the Oregon Center for Public Policy and your allies, other groups you're working with, what are you advocating for? What's your alternative vision? And maybe how does it differ from what the Democrats in the legislature are calling for?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that as a result of this underinvestment, we've seen growing inequality across the board. And so what we're proposing is really centered around three critical principles. First of all, we have to take an approach towards raising revenue that is progressive. In other words, asking those that can't pay more to actually do so. Secondly, it has to be obviously we have to be able to meet the needs. And so you mentioned, you know, the numbers being thrown around right now as $2 billion for K through 12 education. The Joint Committee on Student Success has come up with this rough figure, and the governor has mentioned it as well. So adequacy is really important. But top of all of those, and top of progressivity, is this notion of equity, because we have to recognize that over the last, you know, over 150 years, we have put in place policies that at their core are racist and have created this deep inequities, not just in terms of income, but in terms of accumulation of wealth over time. So this is an opportunity now to begin to correct the cycle, to correct these policies, so that we can come up with a set of proposals that actually will have a long shelf life.
Okay, and in terms of the sort of issues of justice and distribution in the source of revenue, let's talk. I know that your organization spends a lot of time researching and talking about the fall in the share of total state revenue that comes from corporations and corporate taxes. Can you talk briefly about what's happened, say, over the last few decades in the corporate tax realm?
Yeah, unfortunately, corporate taxes in Oregon have been actually decreasing as a source of all income collected by the state, all income taxes collected by the state. So, you know, just about 20 years ago, that level was about 18, almost 19% of all income taxes collected were paid for by corporations. And as of 2015, that number is about 7%. So it's a pretty significant decrease in terms of what corporations in our state are contributing to the common good.
And what are the sort of vectors by which that's happened? How has that share dropped so dramatically? What are the various causes?
Well, there's been a number of changes in policy that have given corporations ways out of paying their fair share. One of them, for example, is that we've changed how corporations report their profits to the state and therefore what is the tax base upon which they can be taxed. So, and you have probably, you know, followed the news reporting on the Oregonian about how Nike, for example, has actually shifted billions of dollars in profit to subsidiaries abroad that actually don't even have employees in an effort to avoid their tax liability in the state. And so what the Oregon Center for Public Policy, along with a fairly large coalition of nonprofit organizations, have proposed to address this issue is to enact what is called complete reporting, upon which corporations would have to report all of their profits globally, and their tax base for Oregon would be determined on the sales of the portion of the sales that are attributed to the state of Oregon. And so that would create a much broader tax base upon which tax corporations.
So it sounds like some of the fall in corporate taxes is an artifact of global changes in the financial sector, in the financial world, and how corporations are managing to hide profits offshore, and that the state law is not necessarily kept up with it. But we also have a string of special tax deals that have been brokered by a series of Democratic governors, actually, with some of the very largest corporations in Oregon, Intel, Nike, Comcast, to specifically reduce their tax bills, either in response to the threat to leave or the threat to not create jobs here. How significant a contributor are those sorts of sweetheart deals?
Well, they're no doubt very significant aspect of the story that has led us to this point. And that is the reality of the political system that we have in the United States, in which corporations can contribute to political campaigns without really any kind of limitation. And so that's created a dependency between elected officials and corporate interests that is difficult to tease apart. I do think that this is when the voice of the people is even more important, because ultimately the voters do have a say in this. So I don't want to give the impression that it's all controlled by corporations, but there's no doubt that when you look at the history of the legislature and past governors, as you've mentioned, we've given a number of tax breaks, created an incredible number of tax loopholes for corporations that have resulted in where we are today.
So corporate taxes is sort of one side of what I sometimes think of as the kind of fiscal straitjacket, if you will, that Oregon is in. Some of the structural restrictions on raising the revenue necessary to perform the basic functions of having a robust public sector and serving human needs. And I think the other side, though, is some of the things that voters have actually weighed in on and enacted over the last decades. And that has to do with the property tax side of things, the series of laws passed in the 90s and the 2000s that enshrine property tax caps and compression in the state constitution, measures 5 and 50, the kicker refund that gives back excesses when the state economists don't estimate the budget correctly, rather than reserving those revenues for spending needs, they give them back in tax refunds, and the supermajority requirement that requires legislators to have 60% majority to raise any new revenue. Of course, it doesn't require 60% to cut revenue. Talk a little bit about that side of the equation and perhaps the income tax side as well.
Well, there's no doubt that, again, so we have on the one side these corporate interests that have the ability to allocate significant resources to either political campaigns for officials or in the context of ballot measures. And so both of those forces have an impact on how Oregon shapes policy. Obviously, both of those processes could be influenced by participation of people to influence those policies. But ultimately, what we have is a legislature that is thinking about, especially when it comes to revenue measures, thinking about how those policies that they're enacting during the legislative session will play out with voters during a ballot challenge. And of course, in the ballot challenge, as we've seen, every election cycle seems to have a higher and higher price tag. And so corporations become the ultimate players in shaping those policies. So we have both the opportunity here to influence policy because of, you have, as you mentioned, two supermajorities in the state and the House with a Democrat governor that I think is aligned with our progressive values. But this is the opportunity where we need to be able to hold those elected officials accountable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alejandro Queral. He's the executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And we're talking about the possibilities for major revenue reform and increasing new revenue in the 2019 Oregon legislative session and some of the barriers to doing that. Before we get into sort of some of your proposals for raising new revenue and the specifics, the nuts and bolts, I do want to just talk for at least a minute about the idea of austerity, the notion of austerity, which, you know, I think in many ways you could think of as sort of the main trick of neoliberalism in a way. These ideas that circulate that seem to sort of become part of the common sense that we have to live within our means, that if revenue falls due to, say, an economic downturn, we've got to cut. We've got to do more with less, or we're broke and we can't raise revenue. And that obviously ignores a lot of the options available to governments to raise revenue. One political party is almost entirely unwilling to raise taxes. But I guess I'm curious to hear your thoughts on these ideas of austerity and how they have influenced the ability to fund human needs here in Oregon.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that politics, especially nowadays, has moved away from facts and has turned into a series of talking points that become part of the narrative. You know, it's sort of this notion of truthiness. If you repeat something that's not true over time, they sort of becomes true. And that's what's happened, these notions of austerity, of cutting budget, of cutting services, or the notion that corporations are going to leave when we increase taxes or change the favoritism that we've afforded them for over the last, you know, two or three decades. Those are false narratives. Our organization, Oregon Center for Public Policy, dwells on the facts. In fact, our motto is because facts matter, and facts matter more than ever now, because that's the only place where we can make sound and rational decisions around our policy. It cannot be about narratives. So looking at corporations and their decisions to stay in a place really have more to do with the quality of infrastructure, the quality of the transportation, their quality of education, having a skilled workforce, than whether they're being taxed or not in and of itself. And so let's move away from these narratives and let's dwell on the facts.
Okay, great. And on that note, let's turn then to specifically what OCPP and your allies are calling for in terms of ways to raise this new revenue. You're part of what's been called a revenue roundtable, a series of labor and other progressive groups, and you proposed a series of particular revenue or tax proposals. Talk about what's in there and what you're calling for.
Well, it's,
and if possible, how much those proposals would raise.
Absolutely. As I mentioned before, we are part of, or you've mentioned before, we are part of this revenue roundtable. That it's a fairly large coalition of progressive groups representing low-income communities, communities of color, rural communities as well, and small businesses. And we all share the notion that this is an opportunity to correct some of the wrongs that the legislature has enacted over time to focus on corporate tax reform. As I mentioned earlier, complete reporting, where corporations would be required to report of their complete profits abroad and in the U.S. In the U.S. But we also have to look at the corporate income tax and the corporate minimum tax. Corporate minimum tax right now, it's $150 for corporations making up to a certain point. We need to change that in order to be able to raise the revenue that we need to invest in education. So in terms of corporate income tax, we may be able, depending on how we structure the policy, ensuring that it's a progressive policy, that it doesn't have a major impact on low-income communities, that then we look at potentially raising up to $1 billion. With a corporate minimum tax reform, we could potentially raise around $300+ million, depending on how we structure that. And much of this has to do with, again, the notion of complete reporting and what corporations are reporting to the state of Oregon as to what is their tax base. So those are critical places to start. The legislature, I think, will be looking very closely. There's a number of legislators that have introduced a number of bills related to corporate tax. And so it'll be an interesting debate moving into the legislative session. But we hope to be able to inform this debate in ensuring that legislators stay true to the values of progressivity, adequacy, and equity.
And then moving beyond the corporate tax rate and eliminating some of these problematic practices like not taxing the entire revenue, what else are you calling for? I see some proposals here in personal income taxes, in commercial and industrial taxes. Talk a little bit about what else is on your agenda.
Yeah, there are a number of other things that we are considering, what we call complementary taxes. So, sure, certainly there's property taxes that we could be looking at. The political environment doesn't seem to be ripe enough to have a conversation of property taxes because it has a whole bunch of other implications, potentially needed changes to the Oregon Constitution. But yes, absolutely, everything has to be on the table, including personal income taxes. We have continued, as I mentioned earlier, continued to see a significant disparity in terms of income. In 1980, the top 1% was making a pretty significant, they have increased the level of income significantly more than folks that are median income levels, which basically, those income levels have stayed flat. So we have to correct those as well. But again, we are playing within a political environment, and where we're seeing more movement and more interest at this point is on the corporate tax reform. So we'll see what happens there, but there's a whole host of other complementary proposals that we are talking about and educating legislators about, and I would invite our listeners to look at what we're proposing on our website, ocpp.org.
And you had also talked with me earlier about proposals to change the earned income tax credit. This is in the personal income tax realm.
And that's a critical element of what, not necessarily this revenue roundtable, there's another coalition of organizations that are moving or trying to move the earned income tax credit. And that we're talking about here is a state match of the federal earned income tax credit. What that does is currently we are at 8% if you are a working individual within certain parameters. If you have children under 3, you get 11% match of that federal earned income tax credit. What we're proposing is increasing it a pretty significant amount. We need to renew it first because it expires or sunsets in 2020. And then we will be proposed to increase it. That's going to bring a lot of federal dollars to Oregon from Washington, D.C., and we'll be able to take care of low-income families that are working.
Okay, and before we wrap up, what do you see as being, you talked about the politically possible, what's being left out of the discussion or ruled off the table entirely at the moment, even with this Democratic supermajority in the Oregon legislature? What's being sort of framed as politically impractical or too much to ask, and how does that square with your vision of a truly progressive, equitable, and robust public sector?
Well, you know, it depends on who you talk to. And I think that there's a sector of legislators that are very interested in doing a whole bunch. And then there's limitations in terms of what the leadership is saying. So, yeah, I mean, we would love to see our whole revenue package moved forward. But what we consider realistic is really around corporate taxes.
And how can listeners get involved in supporting OCPP's agenda and the vision you've outlined? Where can they go to find out more?
Go to our website, ocpp.org. We have a newsletter, and we provide updates regularly, particularly during legislative session.
Great. I've been talking with Alejandro Queral, the executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about tax and revenue politics in the Oregon legislature in 2019. Thanks so much, Alejandro, for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure.
Money. When you haven't any coal in your stove and you freeze in the winter and you curse to the wind that you faint. When you haven't any shoes on your feet, your coat's thin as paper and you look 30 pounds underweight. When you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you to love evermore. But when hunger comes to rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat at the window.
At the window.
Who's there?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door. Money makes the world go round, the world go round the world. Money makes the world go round, the clinking, clanking sound. Money, money, money.
That was, of course, Liza Minnelli and Joel Gray from Cabaret. And before that, we heard Dan Jaffe talking with Alejandro Queral, executive director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about Oregon's state budget and the 2019 legislative session. Later on today's show, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will be looking at the cost of debates on border politics and how we can turn away from the mainstream media's focus on building a wall or spending on high-tech measures and more agents, and instead invest in the real security of more open borders. But now, we turn to Bill Resnick's conversation with Jay Youngdahl about bolstering retirement security.
Hi, Jay Youngdahl. Welcome to KABU.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jay Youngdahl is a practicing lawyer. His office is in Texas. He represents poor people, workers, civil rights struggles, unions, actually throughout the South. Serves as a union trustee on pension funds. He's also written a great deal, particularly warning unions by exposing how Wall Street brokers, fund managers, are exploiting the pension funds and the retirees. He also writes on how the funds, often large pools of money, could be used for workers and often are not. Because of his expertise, he has also operated as a fellow or researcher at various think tanks, and he's now a visiting professor at the Murphy Labor Institute at the City University of New York. I read his recent article in the journal New Labor Forum titled Bolstering Retirement Security, which we will talk about, indeed, more than bolstering, because many, there is very little retirement security, and that includes many who don't qualify for Social Security. Jay, tell us about what's the big problem for all of us, not just us oldsters, about pensions and income security.
Well, as a society, we want to make sure that all folks in the society are treated well, and certainly the oldest among us. People claim to be for that, but unfortunately, if you look at what's happened in our country in an increasingly accelerating rate, older people cannot expect a dignified and healthy old age. And it's become a crisis, and it's a crisis throughout the country, from the East Coast to the West Coast. There's a variety of reasons for it, like healthcare, pensions are complicated. But it's something that can be done and should be done. I think there's no question that there is the political feelings among people that something should be done. And so for me, the issue is to try to clarify what the problems are, what the potential solutions are, and hopefully a movement forms to move in that direction.
Let's talk about the old system, which is now in very rapid decline, the defined guaranteed pension from your company. There were a lot of people actually who enjoyed that, including auto workers, certainly not a majority, but it was a considerable group of people who could rely on a decent pension. That's ended, is my sense.
That's pretty much right. When one gets older, you have a risk about having enough money in order to live and do what you need to do, especially as your body and mind start to deteriorate. And in the past, we had a system that made the risk a collective risk, a communal risk, and it was called defined benefit plans. And workers were promised, in exchange often for wages or things they gave up in collective bargaining, that they would receive a certain defined benefit at a certain age that they could count on. And so the risk, you might say, was put together because the younger workers at the location were worked, kept putting money in. And so there was that communal feeling, and the risk was on the pool. Since then, however, this risk is being transferred to individuals themselves. Some folks can carry that risk, but most of us can't carry that risk. And so they've switched from what's called defined benefit to defined contribution. Around 1980, a third of the workers had in our country had really very good defined benefit plans that protected them, they could count on. That number has fallen from that number to 2%.
2%. Those are mostly public employees right now, is that right?
Well, right. So the 2% is of people who only have defined benefits. And what's happened is that we've been kind of sold this bill of goods that we can switch to something called defined contribution. And that's like a 401k, where you put in a certain amount of money every year from your job or every month. And then you have a certain amount of money at the end, and you have to figure out how you're going to spend the money or how you're going to allocate it over the years. The problem with that plan is it puts everything, all the risk, on the individual. And the way they're set up, people are able generally to take money out of there. So in these precarious times, many, many people have taken all their savings out of 401ks. As soon as you're able to put some money in, within a month or two, you need to take it out for health care or for whatever. So at this point, the average person has just a few dollars in their 401k, and many, many people have none at all.
And the median is, however, about $24,000, I think you wrote.
That's exactly right.
$24,000, the income per year, even if you're really lucky, is is a little over $1,000. Even if it's well invested, which many of them aren't, it's nothing. Basically, they've done away with the pension, except for the really high earners who supplement by putting a lot of money into a 401k.
No, that's right. There's a few little green shoots that are coming up. California has a program called Secure Choice that's going to be a little helpful. But essentially, it's a disaster right now for older people. I just saw an article about situation in Maine. And in Maine, I think a majority of the seniors have no private pension. About 35% of Maine seniors are now at risk for going hungry. And it's because they don't have any pension. And it's a crisis.
And poor people who have not had covered employment or who work in the gray economy, who don't have enough quarters on Social Security, they can wind up with nothing or sort of a minimum payment, which is like $800 a month that you can't possibly live on. They're just forced out on the streets, and there's going to be more and more people in that position.
Well, that's right. And as you see what's called the fissuring of the economy, we have more and more folks working in so-called gig jobs, working for Uber or delivering food, but you're essentially putting no money away. And so those folks are going to have nothing when they finally retire. One of the scandalous things in this area is that there are a number of so-called progressives, especially on the West Coast, who laud this kind of gig work for the freedom and the flexibility, yet there's no discussion about how that kind of job can keep a person not only alive now, but can allow one to put some money back for one's retirement when they get old.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, although some people then have to move in with their kids. And what you have is poor people, precarious people, huddling in rental homes or whatever, hoping that their health care doesn't disappear. This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole. I'm talking today with Jay Youngdahl on pensions and how they are disappearing. The crisis now for older people. We've talked about private pensions and how they are offered to nearly nobody today. That is a decent pension being replaced by 401ks that are hopeless, managed by brokerage firms and all sorts of investment advisors who take big fees. They don't sound that big at the beginning, but it becomes a very large amount of money over the years.
Well, that's true. Your state, Oregon, has one of the worst records. The Oregon Investment Board taking money that's set aside for Oregonians and their pensions and shoveling those to Wall Street. They were involved in putting money into the Toys R Us closing and some of those other things. And it's really, it's a sad thing for a pretty progressive state like Oregon to be involved in.
Well, it advertises itself as progressive, but on a lot of issues, it's not at all. Let's get to Social Security because, in fact, whereas the benefits are pretty secure right now for the aged, there's a lot of powerful groups and powerful in Congress and powerful in the Democratic Party even that almost succumbed to a great reduction in Social Security during the Clinton years. But in any event, there are those who want to save Social Security by limiting benefits in a lot of ways, making it actually less and less useful for working people. Tell us about what's happening with Social Security.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the 20th century in the U.S., Social Security and then number one and maybe Medicare number two are really the crowning glories of our society. It's easy to judge a society by how well it treats its own people, especially those considered the least among us. Social Security and Medicare are really fantastic. They continue to be fantastic. But now there is a concerted attack on Social Security. In fact, there's been one for a number of years. And it comes from three different places. One is kind of an anti-government feeling that the right wing stirs up. I mean, the Koch brothers finance a lot of that. We see that in all kinds of different ways, think tanks, lobbyists, et cetera. And they make up stuff like Social Security's broke. Social Security's not broke. Never has to be broke, never will be broke, unless people try to break it. But the second is, it's part of the so-called great risk shift. As you were saying, even some progressives think, why should I take on the risk of helping my fellow citizens? Because I'm more meritorious than they are. I'm smarter than they are. I went to better school, and they're just kind of lazy, or they don't work very hard. And why should we all be together like that? And the third is that the amount of money that can go to Wall Street and the different private equity and hedge funds is just enormous. That's another source of money for those who are lobbying to do away with Social Security. And unfortunately, a number of people have been kind of hoodwinked about that, mainly, frankly, because those forces put money into think tanks. Think tanks hire academics, and for a lot of academics, they either want that second job or they want that first job. And then you can't rock the boat too much on the person who's giving you the money. And so we see some of that, especially in the New York City area. I've seen some of that recently. So the attacks are coming from those three places. At this point, we've been able to hold it off, mainly, I think, because American people realize what would happen to grandpa or grandma or dad or mom or themselves if there was no Social Security. And so there hasn't been the political appetite for it. But my suspicion is that in both your and my lifetime, we're going to be fighting this battle until we pass away. So it's an important battle. At this point, we're ahead, but it's one we have to keep a very close eye on because it's a wonderful program.
We're ahead, but they've put a lot of energy into convincing the young that Social Security is just broken. It can't keep paying its benefits, and it's really just you're subsidizing all those older people who already have enough money. That sort of idea has caught on with at least some of the young, I'm afraid. They're not going to do away with Social Security. That would create a revolutionary situation that they don't want to face. I think their strategy, though, is to gradually cut away at it and reduce it so it becomes less and less important. One way they could do it is just by cutting the cost of living allowance, right? Or another way they could do it is just by raising the age of retirement. It's just a percentage here, a percentage there. But in 10 or 20 years, what you've done is just destroy the program.
Well, the age issue is an important issue because in our society, people do different jobs. So one of the things I've done during my career is work in workers' compensation areas where people have been hurt. Well, if you're a warehouse worker and you hurt your back, you can't work anymore. But if you're a banker and you hurt your back, you can still work. And it's the same way with the kind of age thing. If you've been a construction worker or a hotel maid, some of these things your whole life, your body breaks down much more quickly than, let's say, you're some kind of bond salesman or stock salesman or something like that. So for those folks and those kinds of occupations, having, let's say, a 70-year-old retirement age may not seem like much of a problem, while for the working class, it's nearly impossible. But the narrative, as you said, with young people is to say, well, age is just a number, and everybody should work until as long as they can. And, you know, there's all these great things about work itself, which I do think there are good things about work if you can do it. But they've taken that narrative and are using it against us, like you say, in convincing groups such as some young people that Social Security age doesn't make any difference. And in fact, it ought to be moved up. The other thing is that what you alluded to is one of the, what I think is one of the bigger problems in society, is the narrative of individualism. In our country, we've always had some narrative of individualism, but we've had times in which the communal or collective instinct has taken over. And those are some of the times that, frankly, our country has done some of its best things. But the individualistic narrative now, which is being pushed throughout society, wow, just happens to be really good for wealthy people and just happens to be really poor for working people. And so one of the things that I work on is trying to think of ways to talk to people about that narrative and to highlight places in our society in which a communal or a collective impulse has had a wonderful effect.
Well, certainly climate change is going to change everything. Fairly soon, people are going to realize they're all in the same boat, and we really have to take control of our economy and reconstruct it completely, and can't leave the poor behind. Tell us about the solutions.
Right. Well, the first solution is to try to protect the few private pensions that are left. That is, those workers who I've been involved in a lot of union negotiations in which the workers gave up a certain wage increase in order to have a pension. Some of those are being taken away. So everything that we can do to help protect the pensions that we have is important. In Washington now, there's a Senate committee on this. It's not making any headway, but maybe after the first year, we'll make some headway. The second is to fight like hell on Social Security, to not only keep it as good as it is now, but to try to improve it, improve the cost of living. And the third is to help people to put money away, and there are certain kind of default things one can do to allow more money to be saved, but it's got to be saved in a way that it stays away from those Wall Street vultures. Because if you look at the effect of fees, if you look at the effect of complexity in terms of what people have saved in their 401ks, that's problem number one. Unfortunately, of the solutions at this part to private savings, has that issue, the issue of fees and Wall Street greed, been addressed? We all understand why, but it needs to be addressed. And so if we did those three things, and there's movements in each of the areas, and there's a strong political constituency, I believe, in the American people for this, if it's explained and a movement can be fostered to protect ourselves and to really move to a period in which, in our so-called golden years, we're able to do the things and to have the kind of security that people should have, the human beings should have.
Jay Youngdahl, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and you too.
When that old age pension check comes to our door, we won't have to dread the poorhouse anymore. Though we're old and bent and gray, good times will be back to stay when our old age pension check comes to our door. When our old age pension check comes to our door.
That was the New Law City Ramblers singing Old Age Pension Check, one of their songs from the Depression. And before that, Bill Resnick and Jay Youngdahl talking about how those checks have been disappearing and what we can do about that. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Remember that in a day or two, you can find our show and each segment on our page on the KBOO website, where you can also subscribe to the show. Finally today, we hear from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with The Left and the Law on Border Politics.
In an article in the New York Times yesterday, Atossa Abramian writes about the symbols and realities of modern national borders. Physical borders used to be to protect against other states, empires, or sovereigns, but today relatively few land borders exist to fend off neighboring powers. She writes, "Modern borders exist to control something else, the movement of people. They control us. But she goes on to add that the us they control is quite a broad spectrum of human situations and circumstances defined by tremendous inequalities and differences in the freedom of movement across borders. Mike, so let's talk about border politics, which of course are very center stage, dominated by the Trump wall these days in the U.S. and of course elsewhere, the dilemmas of Brexit, that for some the nightmare that doesn't end with Brexit. What about the economic and moral arguments for open borders? Let's start with what that concept means, which for some people is a scare. Even the Democrats, the idea of open borders is throwing down the gauntlet before them in a way they don't want to take up. What about that term, open borders?
Well, it's true. The Democrats flee from it. It's used as a cudgel these days to beat people, say the Democrats are secretly in favor of open borders, as if it's a bad thing.
Like in my world of psychology, it's like saying you have very bad boundaries. It's a boundary function that clearly serves a lot of imagined needs, more imagined than real.
Well, the notion of open borders is very different, say, than the idea of asylum or making moral decisions over who tells poignant stories the best about who gets to come in. The idea of open borders, well, we knew it in the United States 100 years ago when people who came to Ellis Island, only 2% of them were rejected. If they had communicable diseases or they were asked a few questions, if they couldn't multiply two by two, but otherwise everybody got in. And there were no moral distinctions drawn at that time.
And that was, of course, tied to the growth of industrial capitalism and the need for labor. And, of course, the history of border politics is very tied to the demands of capital for labor.
Well, there's two or three aspects or reasons, I think, that are very strong arguments in favor of open borders. And the first is economic. I mean, the estimates are staggering about the amount of money left on the table because we do not have open borders. $1 trillion is a common number.
The part of the equation must be the costs of enforcing borders. The budgets, even hiring border guards is a staggering number, as well as all of the other expenses attached to border guarding.
The last number we have is the year for 2013, but it was $18 billion then. It's certainly gone up since. So there's all the elaborate machinery.
That's part of what's meant by militarizing the border.
Yeah, militarizing, and then the whole elaborate process of determining whether you get a work visa for particular technologies. That's all extremely expensive. But the idea of labor being mobile, as is capital. You know, Ford Motor Company wants to build a new car plant in Mexicali. They can do it and take advantage of cheaper labor there, people who are not allowed to leave. That means that it keeps the cost of labor down in Mexico, so it's an attraction. But if labor were also as mobile as capital is, the efficiencies, the increase in economic activity would be stunning. It has always been, every time it's been tried, it's not only a theoretical concept, but there have been three or four studies done, mostly financed by libertarians, really wealthy libertarians, that make it really clear, both practically and theoretically, that there'd be an immense increase in economic activity generally. And just as economic activity in this country meant that Irish Catholics and Italians and Jews who came here after the preceding waves of Protestants had come here have all flourished mightily in this country, and that there's no difference now in that this similar increases would happen if open borders were allowed now.
And there are arguments from the right and the left around open borders. And it's in some ways startling to see the number of editorials in the Wall Street Journal and mainstream press over the last few years arguing for open borders. The mobility of labor and capital is fundamental to our system. But those arguments also don't take into account the inequality that gathers up, whether the borders are soft or hard, and that people come from areas of the world where they come here with needs as well. And part of the discourse on borders in Europe is very, very much centered on asylum and refugee, the needs of people who are fleeing situations of conflict and our moral responsibility to provide extra forms of care. And I think that is where now the moral arguments line up here in this country too, that there are people who are fleeing desperate situations. And so the moral arguments tend to be aligned with a call for certain kinds of support, not only freedom of mobility, but that we have an obligation to help people in situations where their circumstances are untenable. Well,
that's an argument for generosity, of being good to your fellow person. But there is a larger moral argument, I think. It's the same argument against apartheid. Why should we care about somebody more because of the place where they were born? Why should your opportunities be defined as they are, by be limited by your race or by an accident of geography? Where's the morality in that? Aside entirely from how anybody is treated anywhere, why should somebody who's born in Nairobi have such fewer opportunities to advance? I think the idea, just as we now look at the idea of slavery, which used to be something very natural, as horrible, or the idea of restrictions placed on gender that seemed, quote, natural before, we're past that now. And I think there will come a time when we see that limitations and restrictions based on geography, based on whim, like the fact that you happen to be born 20 miles south of somebody else, can make such a huge difference in the possibilities you have in living your life.
And for affluent Americans, it's a taken for granted freedom of movement, not only of capital, but a certain amount of affluence, that you can go travel pretty quickly across, fast track across borders and retire or move to other places of the world, and the world being kind of seen as your oyster. But there is a different kind of moral lens cast on people who want to come to this part of the world for economic reasons. It has a different moral cast, and it becomes conflated with smuggling, with criminality. You know, even in Norway, that has had very soft borders with its neighbors, and along border with Sweden, that was virtually visible. Now with this right-wing government, there's a lot of focus on all these people bringing alcohol into Norway because it's very expensive. I can tell you, buying a bottle of wine in Norway, by the way, is very expensive. And people, bootleggers, or people bringing in goods without paying taxes. And of course, that is part of soft borders.
Well, people use spectacular individual examples of crimes as arguments, both in Europe, where in Germany, the rape and murder of a teenage girl really set the idea of accepting refugees back. And here in this country, Trump's seizing on the example of the woman who was shot in San Francisco. But in the larger view, it's very clear that immigrants are not committing any more crimes than an average mix of Americans. They also pay more taxes than they get in welfare benefits. There's rational arguments, but
There's a lot of criminal activity across state lines, too. We may see more of that in the coming years. So this fantasy that all of the thugs are stopped at the border doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Although one can say, yes, there will be different forms of criminal activity and are with soft borders, but in general, the hysteria around that doesn't hold up to the facts.
There will be losers. You know, there will be people, especially at unskilled levels, who will be temporarily hurt, but the immense increase and economic activity will ultimately sweep them up. But there will be, for people who define their identity from their nationality, it's a precious thing. They want the fewer the better. There's some sort of like, it's like a diamond in my chest that I it's a precious thing that I don't want to dilute by having others. For that
a positive kind of stigma.
People who are proud to be an American as if they had anything to do with that fact that they're an American. It's fine to feel lucky. It's fine to feel grateful. But the idea that you made some sort of accomplishment by managing to be born here is silly.
Yeah. And many, many commentators, including Abramian, who have taken up this question of if you don't have much else, that's something, you know, the refuge of those who have little else to hold but those kinds of prejudices. But I think one thing that's different about the Brexit debate now in the UK is that there's a kind of sober assessment of the cost of that thinking and people not wanting to resurrect that wall with Ireland and how horrible that wall was because it was a symbol of and a target of so much pain and suffering. And tearing down walls like the Berlin Wall have become kind of monumental moments of human capacity to reach across borders. And perhaps the Democrats could build on something like that, that we should be tearing down borders and having ritual moments of transcending them, where we walk across them.
Well, it would require some bravery, but I think it could go unexpectedly well. Rather than recoiling in fear, as the Democrats traditionally do, rather than saying, well, we don't really mean open borders. Of course, we also, but we just want to be a little more humane.
We have a high-tech notion of hardness. They're so right. They do. It's sort of a difference between the old-school Republicans, the steel and concrete versus high-tech borders. It's kind of pathetically true.
It is. It really is. But I think they should
embrace it. But there's an opportunity to take this up.
There really is. You know, it's interesting how the Brexit debate is focusing now on Ireland, where the real costs of borders is being highlighted. The memories of how terrible it was for Northern Ireland to be physically separated and to have all the elaborate barbed wire and separation versus
yeah,
what's
and all
now.
Of the ways you could never travel from country to country in Europe. You know that, and when in. After the EU was established, you could drive from France to Germany, who no one would have thought possible, across those borders. No one would have thought possible in the 60s. And what a treasured freedom that became. And we could maybe emulate some of that.
Well, if the Democrats seized these economic arguments, went on the offense about it, I think it might fare better than their reflexive fear suggests.
Redefine strength,
talk about economic advancement. There would be tremendous opportunities. They could get a wide variety of supporters. They could, you know, unions have traditionally foundered on ethnic differences and religious differences. But
yeah.
They could also learn to embrace this model of accepting people at every level. Whoever wants to come here.
Uh-huh. There's a lot to work out, but there always will be.
There always will be.
Okay, this is Jan Hocken and Mike Sendiker talking today about arguments for open borders.
That was Alam with the song Open Borders, and before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing that very topic. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. Thanks to Jan and Mike for their Left in the Law segment. Thanks to Dan Jaffe and his guest, Alejandro Carral, for their discussion of Oregon state budget, and to Bill Resnick and his guest, Jay Youngdahl, for their conversation about pensions. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering and to Clayton Morgeridge for editing. Thank you for being part of KBOO. If you're not yet a member, you can contribute money by clicking on the Donate Today image at the top right of the station's webpage, and you can contribute time by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Also on the KBOO website, you can find the Old Mole Variety Hour archives, and in a day or two, those will include this very show. You can also subscribe to our show from that page. Tune in again next Monday at 9 a.m. for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's grassroots perspective. And remember, you can get your interim Mole fix by listening to Joe Clement this Friday at 8 a.m. discussing the meaning of class on Positively Revolting. Thanks for listening.